Word of mouth.
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 Mouth. There's a raw wind blowing. A tumbleweed rolls across the dusty road. A door flaps in the breeze. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today's word of mouth is all about, you guessed it, ghost towns. This hour will go far beyond the abandoned boom towns of the Old West and reveal the unexpected ghost towns on your computer, buried underfoot, maybe even in your own backyard. But we'll start with a ghost town that was teeming with life just a few months ago, one that millions of people around the world saw on their television sets and computer screens. In January of this year, Russia dominated international headlines. We were yet to hear about troops gathered on the borders of Crimea or Ukraine. The coverage was then all about whether the seaside resort town of Sochi was ready to host the Winter Olympics. Less than 6 months after the world descended on Sochi, those newly built streets, hotels, and arenas stand empty. Sochi is a $51 billion ghost town. From Athens to Beijing to Lake Placid, photographer John Pack and filmmaker Gary Hustwit have been documenting what happens after the Olympic hullabaloo is over. Their photo book and ongoing project is called The Olympic City. John Pack, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
And Gary Hustwit, great to have you with us.
Thanks.
Now, Gary, seeing reports of Russia struggling to make use of Sochi now that the Games are over, I wonder if that's a trend you found as you revisited cities around the world for this project.
Yeah, well, there's always this, conflict between short-term, a flash of having the Games and the kind of long-term planning and long-term benefits of the people who actually live in these cities. So it's something that we've seen certain cities have handled better than others. And, the jury is still out on Sochi. It has all the earmarks of, I think, a failure in terms of long-term usability and feasibility. I mean, I think they really just wanted to have a two-week party and kind of be the center of the world for that time and weren't really thinking about, what was going to happen afterwards.
Yeah, really expensive party. You went as far back as the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. What's left of the facilities there?
Well, the Olympic Stadium that the famously Hitler built and is featured in the Leni Riefenstahl films is still an active, football stadium. It's very much in use, and as are the surrounding areas. I think the most interesting thing in Berlin from the 36 Games is the Olympic Village, which ended up in kind of East Berlin after the war and was then used by the Russian army as a base. And after the Berlin Wall fell and the Russian troops withdrew, it's just been kind of a ghost town for the past 20, 30 years. It's pretty amazing to see the pool and all these training facilities are there, but it's just covered in graffiti and just completely abandoned.
Right. I think there's always been talk of, should we tear the stadium down? We don't want to remember this history. But I think they just have it. They've sort of been in this limbo for years and years.
Well, Gary, the modern Olympics started in 1896. How far back does this tradition of building extravagant facilities go?
Wow, even those early Olympics like Amsterdam and things like that in the early teens were building stadiums. I think the city that first purpose-built an Olympic Village was actually Los Angeles in 1932. They built an entire kind of, these little clapboard houses that, housed all the athletes and officials in what now is the Baldwin Park neighborhood of L.A., and afterwards, they auctioned them off and people kind of took these little structures and, used them as sheds and things like that. So there's no actual trace of the Olympic Village from 32 in Los Angeles. But, all these cities, I think, have tried to put their best face forward because they know that the world is watching. And I think it's interesting that the kind of architecture that comes out of the Olympic development is always this a city trying to kind of personify itself in the structures and show themselves to the world in this ideal self-image that they have.
Maybe one of the most disturbing Olympic venues to fall into disrepair, according to your photographs, is Athens, perhaps because of its history, also because the Summer Games were only 10 years ago. John, I wonder if you can paint us a picture of what it looks like now.
When I visited there, 21 of the 22 venues were fenced off, and guarded.
Fenced off and guarded?
Yeah, I mean, I think they even passed a bill, that required press to get permission to visit these sites because it was such, I think it's because it's such an embarrassment, and they don't really have the money to maintain these sites.
There's a photograph of one of the stadiums with just grass, and weeds growing in the middle of the green.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly nature takes over if you don't maintain it, especially when you build an 80,000 seat venue. What are you going to do with that after? If you don't have a football team, a soccer team to go in there, then you have to maintain this gigantic stadium that you use a few times for concerts or something.
I think a lot of times the cities are like, if we build it, they will come.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be some use or business to come in and sponsor these places or sports teams. But
I think everyone gets caught up in it too. So there's, I think they have a lot of people and companies saying, oh yeah, we'll definitely be interested in renting these spaces or in Athens malls were supposed to come in, shopping malls and all sorts of things. And now I don't think any of it really came together.
Again, I think they see it as a big PR stunt. I mean, who knew even what Sochi was before last year?
Right.
No one did. And I think a lot of people didn't even really have a real image of Beijing until those games. And now the bird's nest and that opening ceremony is just, in everyone's head. So in a certain sense, they accomplished what they wanted to. They weren't going after long-term, livability improvements in those cities, so that they got what they wanted.
John Pack, the photographer, and filmmaker Gary Hustwit is with us. We're talking about a project that they're doing. They're documenting Olympic cities after the Olympics have passed on. Are there any examples of arenas or villages being used? You mentioned some of the villages have turned into housing, but had some sort of what they call adaptive reuse now in urban renewal circles that have helped sustain the positive impact of hosting an Olympics?
Well, I think there's a couple pretty interesting examples. John photographed Lake Placid, and I think they've got one of the best after uses of their Olympic village.
Well, I mean, they didn't have the money to bring the Olympics in 1980, and they asked the government for money, and they said, we don't do that unless you make something federal that we can use afterwards. So they decided to make a prison where they already had a prison. So they've got a bunch of money from the federal government to build a federal prison. They housed the athletes in the prison for the games, and then afterwards they moved the prisoners back in. And the prisoners from the other jail actually helped, build the trails and things for the Olympics. So it's a very interesting reuse for that.
John,
I don't know, positive is the word.
Yeah, good point, but it strikes me, John, these pictures, they often look so sort of haunted in their own way. And aside from what they were used for in the past, what is it about photographing abandoned places that makes them so good, such good subjects?
Yeah, I don't know. Gary, you try it. Let me think about it.
Well, I think it's always striking to see, especially in the case of the Olympic venues, these structures that were built with this, a very kind of idealistic idea of sport and of nations coming together, and they're very kind of celebratory. But after the party's over, they just take on this a different quality almost immediately. There is a kind of a sense of the ghosts of what happened and how it kind of imprinted in the city. And it probably goes even deeper than the architecture. I think a lot of these places, like Sarajevo is a great example that John documented, that's part of the city's real and the citizens' kind of cultural identity. It's a point of pride that they hosted these games. And even something like Sarajevo is totally destroyed and, in the war and all these venues are just, were completely sort of bombed out. there's still this sense of everybody has an Olympic story there, and it is still part of the sort of DNA of the city, and it is kind of this positive thing that they carry.
So any plans to go to Russia soon and photograph Sochi, or is it still too soon?
I think it's a little too soon. I'm more interested in I think we're both interested in how it looks, you know, 2, 3, 4 years from now. The hangover hasn't gone away yet from the big party. So we want to see when things kind of return to kind of quote unquote normal. I think that's when it's probably the most interesting for us. But it is an ongoing project. I mean, we're going to keep going to cities. I know both of us are vying to try to go to Tokyo because there's so much of the 64 Games legacy, but also how they're changing the city for the 2020 Games. We have an invitation to go to Rio de Janeiro and exhibit the photos later this year, and I think that's going to be fascinating.
Stir some stuff up.
Yeah, well, how the World Cup fares there, but also just in the next couple of years in the run up to their game. So it's very much a conversation among people who live in these places, and it's something that we're excited to keep following.
Gary Hustwit, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And John Pack, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, you're welcome.
That's John Pack, the photographer, and Gary Hustwit, the filmmaker. Together, they are the creators of the Olympic City Project and Photo Book. You can see some photos at our website at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, an underground ghost town courtesy of the Cold War. We're going to hear about a couple who transformed an abandoned nuclear missile base into their home. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Though the Cold War is behind us, the relics of the era remain. Producer Eric Malinsky visited a peace activist turned real estate agent in Kansas named Ed Peden, who buys and sells decommissioned underground nuclear missile bases and silos. Some of his clients turn them into homes. Ed even raised his family in one. His wife hardly notices the lack of windows, though Ed admits that his daughter never chose to live in a hole. So, what's home-like life underground?
The first time I had the dream was in October of 1984. I was watching a Celtics game with my parents, and the emergency broadcast signal suddenly came on.
From the Oval Office at the White House.
My fellow Americans.
President Reagan told us that the missiles had been launched. There's nothing else we could do. I've talked with other people my age, who were kids in the early 80s, and I know that I'm not the only one still haunted by those days. So I was really fascinated when I read about this couple in Kansas who moved into an abandoned nuclear missile base. I had to see it for myself. I flew into Kansas City and I drove a couple hours west to the town of Dover. I drove up a dirt road until I came to a barbed wire gate. There was a little shack on top of a hill, which was suspiciously large compared to the flat farmland around it.
What do you put above a missile base? An English two-door does not make it here. A log cabin really doesn't fit the scene here. We're still working on that one.
Diana Payton lives here. She's heard it all from the neighbors.
The hole in the ground, the cave, earth dwellers, Hobbit, that's a good one.
Living in a nuclear missile base was her husband Ed's idea. Ed Payton has long gray hair and John Lennon spectacles.
In the early 1980s, I was teaching some current events classes, Topeka West High School, and I was hearing locals talk about the missile site. And I was amazed the place was grown up in weeds. There was metal debris everywhere. It was totally trashed. There was a lot of talk in the news about the possibility of nuclear exchange, and yet this hardened underground nuclear-proof structure was flooded and abandoned and ignored. This made no sense to me.
In 1960, the government spent $3.3 million building this base. They only used it for 5 years, but it was active during the Cuban Missile Crisis. In 1983, Ed purchased the site for $40,000. That would be like buying a $23 million home today for $84,000. And the sale went fast. The government didn't care. Even the Soviets knew this kind of missile base was outdated. Of course, it's not abandoned now. We walked down the driveway to a massive garage door, wedged into a hill.
This door is 20 feet wide, 18 inches tall, and weighs 47 tons.
The garage door can't be opened from the outside, so we enter through a little side door. We walked up a corrugated tunnel, and then took a sharp left into two rooms that were each the size of a high school gym. The walls and pillars had that military-industrial look, including light bulbs and cages.
Overhead, this entire ceiling is a massive door, weighs 400 tons, that rolled back to the west.
Wait. So this ceiling rolls back?
This way, yes, to the west, yeah. That was supposed to retract in about 25 seconds. And then all of this mechanism back here, this yellow mechanism, the very large chains, would pull the rocket upright.
I know it sounds anatomical.
I have a poem that speaks to this. Unzip the door, erect this phallic-looking missile, shoot it 6,000 miles across the planet.
We walked through another tunnel until we got to this control room. The lighting was really dim. There was a console that was full of dials and switches and buttons. It looked like the set of a Cold War movie.
And this is for an Atlas E rocket. We have the manual here, so we could actually do the launch. See, there's the panel as it is here. Someone unfortunately ripped off some of the very, very most special buttons. But here's a commit button.
And the commit button's actually red.
Yeah. And then here's the rotary telephone where we call the president and ask him if he's sure.
Yes, please launch the missile.
Oh my, I don't know.
The control room was next to the barracks where the soldiers used to sleep. And that's now Ed and Diana's living room.
And my wife particularly thought this is a pretty heavy energy down here. We have brought in spiritual artifacts, artwork, and so forth from many of the world's spiritual traditions. This is a Hindu piece over here, and these are Native American pieces. This is kind of a pagan goddess piece there. These are Islamic prayer rugs.
It looked like the 60s counterculture had staged a sit-in and never left.
We see this entire project here as a transformational symbol.
Maybe, but it's still their house. There's a den with a couch and a TV. They built a nice modern kitchen. The walls are low. Each room opens up to the next. Diana feels very comfortable here.
I hardly even consider the fact that we don't have windows.
But their daughters never chose to live in an underground missile base.
My daughters had mixed reviews on the site, and they had cast parties and birthday parties here where there was a lot of room for dancing and that kind of thing. And then there were other days when their moods were not so buoyant where they would say, Dad, why do we live in a hole?
There is a shaft of light coming down through a spiral staircase, and they try to go up to the surface at least once a day. There's even a pond on their property. But as Ed points out, an underground house does leave a small carbon footprint.
If we owned this much space on the surface in a traditional structure, we probably couldn't afford to heat and cool it. But underground, this is a very stable temperature under here.
The old missile base had to be off the grid, so the military built a power plant inside. Ed and Diana weren't sure what to do with this gigantic empty room, so they turned it into a nightclub. They built a wraparound balcony and a stage with theatrical lights.
So there's now chairs all around here and drums. I assume you have drum circles?
Oh, yes, we do. We love to play drums. We do.
United in spirit by the pipe and drum, we are as one.
Before you start thinking that Ed is a complete hippie, think again. In the mid-90s, he started buying and selling abandoned nuclear missile bases, and he discovered something about himself. He's pretty good at this whole capitalism thing. His clients range from data storage companies to reclusive rock stars.
In the beginning, 10 years ago, we were selling lots of properties at $40,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. There's none of that now. Even the roughest, flooded, terrible-looking place will sell for over $100,000. And the ones that are refurbished are quickly selling in the millions of dollars.
I told Ed about the nuclear nightmares I used to have as a kid. And he had the same experience, the classic Cold War childhood.
I was in elementary school in the 1950s, and then I was in high school, 1961 through 1965, the exact same years that this was an active nuclear site. I remember hearing planes in the sky as a young boy, wondering if this was a good plane or a bad plane. And I think for the first time more than ever, parents could no longer tell their children, "It'll be okay, I will protect you, you're safe." There wasn't that anymore.
Or maybe kids just didn't believe it anymore.
As the windshield melts, then my tears evaporate.
And that story came to us from producer Eric Malinsky. If you'd like to see Ed Peden's subterranean lair, find photos on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Today's show is all about ghost towns, and up next we're going to tour through the virtual ghost towns gathering dust on the World Wide Web, a tour of abandoned websites after the news.
Ashes and diamonds, foe and friend, we were all equal.
Yeah. Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today we're talking about ghost towns, forgotten places that once teemed with human activity, but have since, for one reason or another, been abandoned. We tend to think of ghost towns as physical spaces, reminders of bygone eras and failed frontier societies. Turns out the internet may be home to more ghost towns than even California's gold country. David Ewalt is a contributing editor at Forbes, and we asked him on the show to discuss these digital ghost towns, the internet's abandoned websites and social networks. Hello, David.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, we often talk cautiously about the fact that once something is on the internet, stays on the internet. So what are some examples of the digital ghost towns that people may not realize even still exist online?
Well, they range from very big sites, you know, to things like Friendster, which we all remember from back in the day, but probably haven't heard that word forever.
Friendster, yes.
And there's also the very small. I mean, there's a lot of people who created homepages. That was a big fad back in the early days of the web. It's my personal homepage. And there's a million of those that are just kind of still out there, haven't been touched in maybe a decade. You know, it says, oh, I'm a college student and I'm now in my 40s. You know, so there's a whole variety of these sites which have either sort of disappeared because of neglect or, you know, companies that sort of faded out of fashion and now don't have the audience that they once did.
But can still be found.
Oh, yeah, they're still out there. I mean, they might be hard to find. A lot of these cases, there's no links to them anymore. And that's sort of the ghost town analogy. You know, if you think about in the Old West, you had these towns which shriveled and died, and now they're just out in the middle of the desert. There's no roads leading to them. Well, that's the case with a lot of these websites. They're still in operation. There's still a computer somewhere serving up these web pages, but nobody links to it. So, like, nobody is ever going to find their way back to that site.
If nobody's looking at them, however, why are they still on the internet? Is it too difficult to take them down because there are no links?
No, it's usually easy to take them down. Sometimes it's just because they're forgotten. I mean, a web page at its most basic level is simply a file. It's, you know, like a word processing file on your computer. And you could have this file describing a web page sitting on a server somewhere, and no one remembers that the file is even there anymore. And so the web server, if it's still in operation, is still just serving up that page. If someone felt like coming and asking for it, which they probably don't, the computer would still say, okay, here's your web page.
Well, there's all that old creative content, you know, that it's been abandoned pretty much by the people who created it, the blogs or Tumblr accounts that people began with such promise and then turned into work, I guess. Facebook pages that go unused. Now, what happens to all of that stuff?
Well, sometimes it disappears. That's actually a problem for a lot of people who are producing content, whether it's you're posting stuff on Facebook or you're posting stuff on your own blog or on a blogging service. A lot of people put a lot of time and thought into writing content and expressing themselves, thinking, oh, you know, this is like writing on paper. It's like writing a diary or publishing a book, but then it's can get lost very easily. It's especially true in the case of the internet where, you know, a lot of the early web pages, people got onto these sort of proto-blogging services and services like Friendster and other places where you'd write about your day, you'd talk about yourself. And so people kind of have these diary entries out there in the wild that are just going to fade and disappear. And someday they'll say, gee, I wonder what happened to that, you know, when I wrote about what I was doing back when I was 18. And they're going to go and the files are going to be gone. They're going to lose a big chunk of their memory.
Aren't these digital ghost towns wasting server space?
Not generally. I mean, web pages are very, very small, relatively, and especially the old ones. If you were writing a homepage for yourself back in 1998, chances are the file for that web page is actually smaller than a Microsoft Word document or even a photo that you might post on Facebook today. That's one of the reasons why they're actually very frequently overlooked and still out there and being served up, is because they're really tiny and people tend to overlook them.
You mentioned Friendster. There are other social networks that aren't abandoned exactly, like MySpace. They just have a fraction of the views, or they're a fraction of as popular as they once were. Our producer, Taylor Quimby, did a piece on deleting his MySpace account. It turns out it took some work.
Well, that's probably true of any social network site, but especially the ones that are sort of neglected and forgotten, because when the less people use it and the less demand there is for services, the less the people who still technically own it care about keeping it updated and working. MySpace is a really interesting example of this phenomenon, because it was at one time one of the biggest websites in the world. It was certainly the biggest social network, had you know, millions and millions of users around the globe. Now it's still up there. It's owned by a consortium of people, including Justin Timberlake of all people.
Wow.
But it's a very different site. You know, the idea is, oh, you'll use this to share your music with friends. But a lot of the content that people once posted on their profile is just gone and hard to get to.
So, David Ewald, what do you think is going to happen to all of these digital ghost towns moving forward?
Well, I think a lot of them will just hang around. You know, like we say, it's you know, some of these sites are just so easy to run, they'll keep running on the server. A lot of them, though, are going to die because the technology will change. I have stories that I wrote for magazines and websites, even on Forbes.com, which is a very modern, well-maintained website. There were stories that I wrote back in 2005, 2006, which used web technologies, which are no longer very well populated and supported. So, you know, you can go to a site as big as Forbes.com and find, you know, dead links to some of my stories and things like that. And I think a lot of these sites are going to disappear that way, because 10 years from now, we're going to be using a very different version of HTML. We're going to be using, you know, all sorts of different technologies that aren't going to quite fit. And so you'll look at these web pages and they'll look like ghost town. The windows are all broken. The buildings are half burned down. Nothing looks like it's supposed to.
Very evocative image to stay with us. David Ewald, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Ewald, contributing editor at Forbes. Now, we've compiled a list of links that will take you to our favorite digital ghost towns. You can take the tour for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. While some ghost towns are so remote they've become utterly forgotten, others may hope to gain new life as tourist attractions. Curious ruins have a way of drawing curious travels, and in the case of one American ghost town, much, much more. Producer Taylor Quimby brings us the story.
Lee Trapp is co-owner of the Transylvania Times, a regional newspaper serving the residents of Transylvania County in North Carolina.
Henry River Mill Village is about an hour outside of Charlotte. It was a textile mill that did primarily yarn. They had 35 houses that were built on the property. Almost all the houses, they're exactly the same.
But unlike the shoulder-to-shoulder suburban developments of later decades, the buildings of Henry River Mill Village were built in 1905. They're like big drafty farmhouses spaced eerily far apart, each one a stone's throw away from the next. By the 1960s, most American mills were already in deep decline, Henry River's included, and in 1975, a man named Wade Shepherd bought the entire property.
2 years later, there was a lightning strike at the mill, and it literally burned the mill to the ground. Many residents stayed on site in the community until about 1985, and while no one lives there anymore and there's not electricity at this point, many of the residents still come back to visit where their, you know, grandparents had lived.
And that's how Henry River Mill Village became a ghost town. A row of empty houses, a general store with nothing to sell, and a crumbling concrete dam that served no purpose at all. And then, more than 25 years later, it hit the big time. In fact, chances are you've seen Henry River Mill Village yourself. You just know it by a different name.
Happy Hunger Games! And may the odds be ever in your favor.
District 12.
Now, before we begin, we have...
To production company Lionsgate, Henry River Mill Village wasn't a relic of the American economy. To them, it was the ideal place to begin shooting their blockbuster adaptation of the Suzanne Collins dystopian novel, The Hunger Games.
The very first shots of the entire movie were filmed there. In fact, the very first shot that which you see later in the movie is PETA in this iconic shot where he's getting ready. You know, it's raining and he's outside his bakery and he's throwing the bread to Katniss so that she can have something to eat. That was the very first shot.
Gary Ross, director of The Hunger Games, loved the peculiar way the village's identical houses spread across the landscape.
He said when he looked at those buildings, you know, that there was a uniformity about them that felt like it had a capital influence.
So in 2011, after years of being utterly abandoned, Henry River Mill Village was teeming with people again, probably more than had ever been there before. Ironically, despite the shattered windows, broken barrels, peeling paint jobs, the production crews weren't there to fix up the place.
When they came to look at the site before, they'd come in the winter. And so obviously in the winter, the grass is all brown, the trees, you know, all the leaves have fallen, and it looked even more depressing. Well, obviously, when they came back in April, it's beautiful. I mean, you know, the grass is green and the trees are really lush. So it took an extensive amount of work to transform that place back so that it felt more depressing. They literally laid sort of blankets over it to get the grass to brown and then to come back. And we always joke they actually had leaf pickers who would take the leaves off of some of the trees in specific ways so the trees would look sparse again.
Thank you so much. Thank you, fans, and thank you.
Lee says that after the movie first came out, people from inside and outside the community started flocking to the property in droves, which made the owner, who was trying to sell it, a little nervous.
It's the kind of area that Way doesn't have gated off. I mean, it's a huge community. And so he had all these people coming, and he saw that there was vandalism happening, and I think he got concerned. Burke County, and actually Ed Phillips, who runs Burke County Tourism, said, listen, Wade, you know, you want to sell this property. This is a great way for you to showcase it.
Now, Lee doesn't just run the local newspaper. She also runs Hunger Games unofficial fan tours, bringing diehard devotees of the movies and the books to all the North Carolina locations where the Hunger Games movies were shot, and continuing to bring a little life back to Henry River Mill Village. Or, should I say, to District 12.
Producer Taylor Quimby there speaking with Lee Trapp, owner of Hunger Games unofficial fan tours. The talk now is that Wade Shepherd, the owner of Henry River Mill Village, may close on a deal to sell the property this week. Last listed somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.5 million. Stick with us. Word of mouth continues with a staple of any good Western ghost town, the tumbleweed, becoming a serious menace across the United States. That story rolls in after the break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tumbleweeds rolling? Must be a ghost town. The cinematic signal of High Plains desolation has an even more pernicious side. It is an invasive species known as Russian thistle, and it's wreaking havoc across the United States. Earlier this year, we spoke with George Johnson. He's a writer based in Santa Fe and a regular contributor to National Geographic, where he wrote about fighting the tumbleweed menace in his own backyard. So, Russian thistle, the tumbleweed we see rolling around in westerns, why should we be worried about this seemingly innocuous, dead-looking plant?
Well, it's just invasive. It takes over any place where you have disturbed soil or just neglected roadways or vacant lots. I mean, they're everywhere out here. And as verified by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's plant database, Russian thistle is growing in every state of the United States except Florida and Alaska.
I guess what we read in your chronicle of the battle is that it's pretty difficult to kill these.
Oh, they're evil, unkillable. You know, they're just horrible. They're like some alien invasion. And it's so funny because, you know, this is the iconic view of the American West, the tumbleweed, you know, loping across the road. And then it turns out it's an invasive species from Siberia.
How did it get here to the United States?
Oh, it's probably a few seeds on a Ukrainian immigrant sock. I mean, basically what they think they know is sometime in the late 19th century in South Dakota, there were some Ukrainian farmers who imported some flaxseed grain from the home country, and they believed that that was contaminated with some Russian thistle seeds, and this is where it got its start. So that was ground zero, and before long it was spreading to the adjacent states and pretty much, you know, the full West, and it had reached California and then headed east, and it's everywhere.
What is it about the plant that makes it difficult to kill and quick to spread?
Well, you imagine this plant evolved in Siberia, so it's one of the harshest places on Earth where anything could grow. So it comes to, you know, any place else, and it's like, you know, retiring to Florida. So it's just, you know, it thrives, and it's been streamlined by evolution so that most of its energy goes into producing seeds and thorns to protect them and stalks that curve over so when the plant dies every year and the wind hits it, you know, it rolls in a ball for miles and miles spreading its seeds.
Uh-huh. So it's just throwing off seed as it's loping along, huh?
Oh, as many as 250,000 seeds for a large tumbleweed. They can be, you know, the size of a Volkswagen bug. You know, I couldn't believe it. Even my own hometown, Albuquerque, every winter now they put up a giant tumbleweed snowman that looms menacingly over the interstate. And I just got an email from a reader down there that said, well, the tumbleweed snowman is back again. So, I don't know. To me, that's kind of sick to celebrate these things, but maybe it's healthy just to acquiesce to the inevitable.
I'll keep rolling along.
George Johnson is a science writer based in Santa Fe. He wrote The Weed That Won the West. You'll find a link to read it and see a slideshow of some of the fantastic photos that went with the article at wordofmouthradio.org.
Drifting along with a tumbling tumbleweed.
I have yet to see any tumbleweeds here in New Hampshire, but we do have our share of abandoned, now wild places, like the lost village of Livermore, a 19th century logging town that was swallowed up by the White Mountain National Forest. All that remains is a collection of mossy foundations spread across the forest floor. There are a handful of New Hampshire ghost towns that the curious can seek out, but NHPR's Sean Hurley was drawn to a relic closer to contemporary life, the remnant of an old street in Keene that goes nowhere and sees no traffic, a ghost road, if you will.
As I drove down the last stretch and got close, I started thinking about how a story about an abandoned road might go. What was there to make of a mile or so stretch of pavement that once upon a time was called Washington Street? I could track the whole thing, front to back. The sound as I got out of the car, the seatbelt, the key, the door opening to birds. That faint transition from inside to out, machine to world, town life to wildlife. How there's a gate, makeshift and irregular. Like they weren't sure what they're trying to stop. Cars or people, or just try to end the road itself. Like several gates fell together, and no one could figure out what. Two white poles, red striped, 10 feet tall, heavy welded crossbeams over half of it, cut pipes and chain dangling across the other side. I put in the sound of that chain as I passed onto the road. By the sound of my footsteps, that show how the real road and the abandoned road went right together. I learned initially about the abandoned road from Alan, who grew up in Keene. He says the people that walk the road don't really want it to be known, and to match that, Alan doesn't want me to use his last name.
And I have friends who say that they remember driving over it. And I can remember as a boy driving that road with my father. Well, I just think it's great that they left it and didn't totally close it off.
The river, always close, is soon the road's shadow, running right beside it, about the same width for the rest of the way. The river noise is like a static, no burbling music, just a thrash of white noise that stretches out like a tablecloth beside the road. Helen says that even though he tried to find out about the road, not much was clearly known or remembered.
But I couldn't find out exactly when it was abandoned and exactly when they built a new highway, Route 9. So I went and talked to Alan Rumrill at the Historical Society, and he said that he was quite sure it was in the early 70s.
The last cars to drive this road, Chevy Impalas, Ford Galaxies, Plymouth Roadrunners, Novas, Fairmonts, Pintos, Coronets. The old late 60s, early 70s cars with their bulky metal shells. Inside, radios playing the Rolling Stones, Ziggy Stardust, Neil Young's Heart of Gold. There were bugs and dragonflies, and I might say it was a little humid. I put on sunglasses, not from the sun, but from the green bright leaves. A warning somewhere here in the story about the poison ivy everywhere. Alan, who's a gardener and amateur botanist, lists off the other plants. Purple trillium, Jack in the Pulpit, red elderberry, Solomon's seal. Rare things too, like rose moss, blue stem goldenrod, the poisonous white baneberry called doll's eyes. The area, Alan says, is famous for its garnets. Granite ledge rises up on one side, veined with feldspar. Inside the feldspar, Alan says, tiny and perfect blood-red garnets.
They're peppered all through there. It's as if somebody took a shotgun and shot them into the stone.
At three-quarters of a mile, the river begins to roar, and down a steep bank, I stand before a heavy waterfall that dumps out through a choke-hold tower of stone into a wide pool. En plein air is what a painter might do, and how I decide to write this story with a pen and paper. Set their easel up if they were here, and paint the road's coal and purple elephant skin. The two green leaves below a blue sky, loose with long peninsulas of smoke and white knots. The black-yellow of the painted lines of the road beside a tea-brown brook. The road not at all apocalyptic. No old grocery carts or tumbleweeds, but the earth burrowing up through the tar, cracking it along into pieces. Both sides going under leaves and needles, and the center split with an upward axe of grass. En plein air, I write, happy to remember the fancy French. I write down that I want to write the whole thing here, at the end of the abandoned road, but not say so. I sit where the road dies in the manner of ocean waves reaching up the sand with round arms, and write down what I remember of my plans, what to include, what not to forget. To start with the sound of the car, the engine, the keys, the door, go into footsteps and river and falls, and end with the sound at the end of the road, if there was a sound that wasn't me, and certainly not the sound of writing. That's my plan, anyway. Unless something in the abandoned road says otherwise. Somehow insists that intention itself, secret and planned, be displayed side by side, like the cars that once drove here might be, as against the loss of the name of the road itself. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Our show may be over, but our tour of ghost towns continues on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
That's where you can find some photos of some wonderful abandoned spots right here in New Hampshire. And while you're there, let us know. Are there any deserted buildings, cemeteries, or roads that stir your curiosity? If so, tell us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio. Thank you.